G'day everybody, welcome to the Tactical Tennis Podcast.
I'm Jacob Meyer.
And I'm Glenn Hill. And over the last couple of podcasts, we've been talking a lot about how to put together a more comprehensive game plan, kind of how to plan to play better tennis. And if you haven't listened to the two podcasts that come immediately before this, I would recommend that you do so, simply because doing that, you'll get more bang for your buck out of this podcast, because we're building on the stuff that we talked about previously.
That's right. So today we're going to dig deeper into this larger conversation about patterns.
Yes, because we started out with the whole idea of how to evaluate your own game, how to get an accurate idea of what your strengths and weaknesses as a player are. And then from there,
we moved on to talking more about what your philosophy for patterns should be and how to build that into your own game. So before we jump in, or not before we jump in, but really jumping in, like, what is a pattern more specifically? How do you define that to yourself?
Sure. So when I think about a pattern, I mean, we're really talking about a sequence of shots, like a pre-planned sequence of shots. And so part of the thing that makes patterns a little bit tricky is that in order for a sequence of shots to actually work when it comes to match play, I have to be able to have a predictable response to each shot in that sequence. So, you know, I can't form a pattern where after the first ball, I have no idea where the ball's coming back, right? That's not a pattern. That's called a single shot. Like if I hit a soft backhand into the middle of the court, my opponent has every option available to him, then all of a sudden it's not really a pattern, because they're probably going to hit a winner on the next ball and things have gone horribly wrong for me. What I really need for a pattern to be a functional pattern is for each shot in that I hit in my sequence to in some way either invite or limit what my opponent's going to do, so that their response, their next shot, is predictable. And so therefore I can build a sequence where it might go, you know, a backhand cross court, followed by an inside-out forehand, followed by this, followed by that, until we get to a conclusion. And so that's when I think about a pattern, what a pattern is. And look, you might have multiple patterns that start in the same scenario. That's fine. But there should be a kind of ABCD sequence of events to any pattern in order for it really to be what I would consider an actual pattern, right?
Yeah, so this concept of sequence is really important, because so many times when we learn, you know, if you go all the way back to when you're a beginning tennis player, we learn shots. You know, it's like, let's go practice a serve. Okay, let's practice a forehand. Let's practice a backhand.
Right.
And very few of us really learn, hey, here's your first day. We're going to practice. You're going to hit two forehands over here and then a backhand over here, and then you're going to move this way and hit another forehand. Okay, and then we're just going to do that a bunch of times. Like, I've never seen a tennis pro teach someone a pattern in the first, you know, three lessons that they've ever had. Like, so the sequencing there is really, really important. What's the point, right? Like, what's the goal of the pattern?
The goal of a pattern really should be to improve my position inside of a point. That's where the whole sequencing comes in, because as my sequence progresses, I would hope, if it's a good pattern, if it's a pattern that works, then as that sequence progresses, my situation's improving. If my situation is getting worse as the pattern goes on, then it's not a good pattern, and I want to find a new pattern.
And there's a way in which you probably... Like, I see the way that you coach a lot of the times, the way that you talk about patterns. If you're not improving your situation with the pattern, then that's not even a pattern to you, right? It's like you're probably making a mistake, or you're just hitting a random shot, or you're doing something that, you know, really isn't helpful for you, right? The whole point seems to be that improving.
Yes,
absolutely.
The longer
the point goes on, the more you can use and impose your patterns, then the better off the player usually finds himself.
Right. And I think it's probably worth noting at this point in the podcast that all a pattern really is going to do for you is improve your odds of winning the point. Okay. A pattern isn't a guarantee of winning the point. A pattern is shifting the odds in your favor, because if you take any competitive tennis match, and let's say that players are going to win about 50% of the points each. Well, at that point, you can flip a coin to decide who's going to win the match. Whereas if I can use patterns to shift the odds of winning any given point, you know, 60-40 in my favor, I'm going to win that match every time. And that's really what a pattern is designed to do. It's, look, it's not that it's this is something that I'm going to go out and it's going to work 100% every single time. It is something that's going to go out and I'm going to win the point more often than I would lose it by using this pattern. The better the pattern is, the better the odds become in my favor. But there's never going to be any sort of guarantee that, oh, if I execute my pattern, I'm 100% going to win the point.
Mm. So it sounds like if we can design where and when and how we where and when we hit different shots and how we react to different shots, then we put ourselves in a position where we can play patterns that theoretically are supposed to improve our position as a point goes on.
Absolutely. And when we think about improving our position, what we're really saying is we're hopefully transitioning. So if I'm on defense, I can use a pattern to transition from defense to neutral, or to transition from defense to offense, or to transition from neutral to offense. It's essentially, it's like a plan of attack, to put it in chess parlance, because I know that you're a big chess player, Jacob. You know, it's like having opening moves in a chess game. It's a plan involving specific shots to get from point A to point B, where point B is hopefully you winning the point.
I once was a chess player. It'd be hard to even, I wouldn't be able to call myself that anymore. But I grew up a chess player, competitive chess player, not a competitive tennis player when I was really young.
Sure.
But you know, this is interesting, because when you bring up chess, then it makes me think of openings and the tactics and the vast amount of gathered knowledge that we have in the chess world, where, I mean, they have essentially, to an outsider, it would look like scripted beginnings to a game, where they're not actually scripted, you know, patterns to begin that game. But what they are is basically openings where both players, when they're high level players, know that there's a lot of blunders that they have to avoid early on in a game. And so there's a narrow choice of options, depending on what your opponent does, as each move progresses. So it's
right.
Like,
so to maybe say that a different way, essentially what it is these high-level players know where the bad moves are. They've figured out what the bad moves are and what the good moves are. They've figured out what their best decisions are in this, the kind of the constraints of how a game might open. And they just limit themselves to those good choices.
Exactly. Because we've studied that. I mean, literally the whole community as a whole has studied that for countless hours, countless options.
Right.
For literally hundreds of years. That's yes. Where the game of chess is a little bit, it's not fully unique, but it's close to it. So
sure.
That's hence we think of it as, you know, this very sort of pinnacle of strategy games, and you know,
yes.
Other people are good. For the people that are going to email me about Go and stuff, that's fine. Email me; that would be great. I don't mind.
Yeah. But, so welcome to the Tactical Chess Podcast, everybody.
No, we're not. We're definitely not doing that. They're much
no,
better,
no, we are not. But so let's talk a little bit more about why should people listening begin to develop patterns, and what's the value in them using patterns when they play?
Well, I mean, what's the value of using patterns at all?
Why are they something that every player who really wants to improve should be using patterns? Like, every player should be using patterns.
Okay, so we've got at least two major categories that we're going to break this down into. The one that I'm going to start with, the answer that I like for this, is to jump in and say, because patterns allow a player to start to develop their game with increased specialization.
Increased specialization, you say? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so I'm going to use an example from my past. Like, as a chess player, I really liked to use three different openings. And like, for those three openings, I was very, very good, right? Like, if I could play those openings, I knew that I could compete with basically anyone I was going to come up against. If you could force me out of those openings, then guess what? I wasn't as good of a player. And so in tennis, like if I can shift most of the play onto my forehand, hey, I can hang with anybody, right? But if I find myself in a position where I'm having to win matches, hitting lots and lots of backhands, and I'm having to hit winning shots with my backhand, well, things get a lot more dicey. So by using patterns, we get to specialize more. So I get to practice the things that I'm essentially good at or that I can execute more and more often. By practicing them more and more often and more specifically and precisely, I get to continually improve in them.
So it sounds almost a little bit like a confirmation bias in a sense, because I imagine if I build patterns that are smart patterns, they're patterns that are designed for me to be hitting my strength as much as possible. But then in the process of executing my patterns, I hit my strength more and more and more. So it becomes stronger and stronger, right?
Yes, it's a confirmation bias in the positive sense where it's beneficial for a person, as opposed to the logical sense when, you know, it's something that you want to avoid.
Right.
But the other way that I think of it, like, we have a friend who's a very high-level surgeon and also a very high-level tennis player. And I think of it like a surgeon specializing in medicine. Like, you're not going to have enough time to do everything at the very highest level. But maybe you have enough time to do a few things, in tennis terms, to play a few patterns at an extraordinarily high level. And when you discipline your game enough so that you structure and frame your whole plan of attack around the patterns that you can specialize in, then you give yourself the opportunity to really become a high-level player or to move up from whatever level that you are at currently.
Sure, that makes a lot of sense. And see, I think about patterns a little bit differently, because to me, I think about them as bundled decisions, right? I mean, if I'm playing a match and I'm in the middle of a point, that's a difficult environment in which to make difficult decisions, sometimes very important decisions. So I don't want to have to think through a 4 or 5 sequence of shots while I'm on the run to my backhand corner at 15:30, 4-5 in the first set of my match. That's not the time that I want to be kind of trying to think 6 shots into the future, right? But then if I'm not able to think 6 shots into the future in that moment when I'm on the run to my backhand corner, that means that I'm literally only thinking of the one shot that's in front of my face. And therefore I'm just hitting tennis balls at that point. Like I'm playing without a real plan. I'm playing without a real direction, okay? Whereas what a pattern does for me is it lets me bundle a sequence of decisions or a group of decisions together into one simple choice of which pattern am I going to run, and I just pick a pattern and the shots within that pattern are already decided, okay? And and hopefully with experience I'm picking a pattern that's suitable for the situation that I'm in. Right. I'm not going to pick a pattern that begins with me hitting an inside out forehand when I'm on the run to my backhand corner to hit a slice backhand on defense. But in doing so, what that also lets me do is now I get to make what is in essence a very complex decision into something very, very simple.
It sounds like you only have to decide, like, okay, well, do I want to hit shot A or shot B?
Yeah, essentially, but instead of shot A or shot B, it's pattern A or pattern B, because I've developed these patterns, when I choose shot A, I know what's coming back from shot A probably, and then I know the shot that I want to hit after that. And when I have the ability to predict somewhat what's about to happen, that means I react more quickly, my positioning's going to be better, I'm just going to be mentally cued and prepared to play a much higher quality next ball than if I just hit the shot that's in front of me without any idea of what's coming back next.
So it seems like there's a huge psychological, I don't know if influence is the right word, but there's this real psychological component that starts to come into play if you're playing match after match and sticking to patterns that are actually designed, that you've set out and said, okay, hey, like, I'm, you know, Dave Smith, and these are my 5 favorite patterns, and this is how I'm going to try and play my points on serve, and this is how I'm going to try and play my points on return.
Okay.
that it seems like it takes a lot of the guessing and the uncertainty and the things that players maybe struggle with psychologically out of those, those high pressure moments when we're
Sure.
competing.
Yeah, so Dave Smith, I just want to congratulate you on the incredibly creative name that you came up with.
I have so many friends that are named like really boring names. I was like, oh man, I don't want to actually like use the wrong guy's name. So I only have one friend named Dave Smith. So sorry, Dave, but we're just using your name as an example.
So Dave, yeah, I think there's two things about that. One is the psychological component of everybody will, as a general rule, perform better when they're in a state of psychological comfort. Like if I feel confident about what I'm going to do, if I feel comfortable with what I'm about to do, I'm probably going to do a better job, right?
Yes.
And then the second is not what I would call a psychological advantage. It's actually a neurological advantage, whereby if coming back to this whole idea of being able to predict what's going to happen next, it when I bundle these decisions together and I practice them over and over and over again, and I work on this sequence, I'm developing a neurological support structure around that sequence of events. My brain's just literally going to do a measurably better job in that situation than if I was inventing the shots as I went along. Because my brain is able, and brains are very, very good. The human brain is incredibly good at anticipating what's going to happen next. It's there's a huge portion of our brain that's literally designed to recognizing pattern to pattern recognition. And when we work within our own patterns, then we are letting the brain operate in a very efficient way, which means it's going to basically react. Our reaction speed's going to improve. Our execution's going to improve. So there's a huge advantage to that. And that, I think, a little bit brings us to what I view as the last piece of value that patterns have, or maybe not the last, but certainly a major one that we should address, which is if I go out on court with a pattern, okay? So let's say that you're somebody who listens to this podcast and you say, this sounds like a great idea. I want to make a pattern that gets me from hitting a cross-court slice backhand, and somehow I want to take this and I want to turn it into me winning the point, okay? And so I walk out on court, and my idea is, look, I want to use this for somebody who hits like a high and heavy inside out forehand into my backhand. So my sequence that I come up with when I'm not on the court is that I'm going to try and play a slice backhand cross court, then run around the next ball and hit an inside in forehand for a winner. Very simple pattern, right?
Yes.
So this is my hypothesis in a sense, and I can go out on the tennis court and I get to test whether or not this pattern works. When somebody hits me a high, inside out forehand, a heavy ball into my backhand, I can play that cross court slice and set up for the inside out forehand and try to hit the inside in forehand and see if this actually comes to fruition or not. And the reality is that might not work. Honestly, unless your slice backhand is incredibly good and you're able to get it into a very specific part of the court, the ball that comes back might not come back into your ad court corner, your backhand corner. And so you're setting up the inside out forehand and the ball may be going to the opposite side of the court. Or it might be coming back in such a way where the inside in forehand going down the line is really a very high risk play, because maybe I play that cross court slice and everybody slices it back low. And now I'm trying to take a low ball over the high part of the end of the short part of the court, and I make a lot of errors. And so maybe my pattern isn't the best pattern out there. But what I can do now is I've gone on court with this idea of the structure, and I've tested the structure. I found flaws in the structure, and I get to tweak it. And I can say, you know what? So I play the cross court slice. So far, so good. Now, I wasn't expecting this, but everybody plays the cross court slice back, which is fine. But now, when I try to hit the inside in forehand, I'm making a lot of errors. So instead of hitting the inside in forehand, let me add another shot to my pattern. So instead, I'm going to take that inside in forehand, I'm going to turn it to an inside out forehand. Okay? So now I've gone cross court slice backhand, it comes back as a slice. I go inside out forehand, right?
Okay.
And now that I've hit that high heavy ball inside out, it's less likely to come back as a low slice. And now I can maybe go inside in on that next ball to finish off the point. And so
Okay.
my pattern's become a little more sophisticated. It's maybe a little more realistic. It's adapting to how play's actually going on court. And that gives me a way in which I can kind of measure my performance on the core and see what is working and then tweak it so that I end up with a pattern that eventually does work and does play to my strengths and things go the way I kind of expect them to.
So in this scenario, it seems like we're using the pattern actually to set almost like a structure where we can not experiment in the sense of just try random things, but experiment in the true scientific sense of purposeful hypothesis testing. Like, this is what I think is going to work. I can try and run it 50 times and see, like, am I winning this more than 50% of the time? Or maybe I feel really great, like I enjoy it, but I'm only winning it 20 or 30% of the time. Well, that wouldn't really be a pattern, because that's not a...
Well, it's a pattern. It's a bad pattern.
Well, it's right. Not improving our position, right? So it's
right.
Not...
Right, well, sure. Well, I mean, that's the goal of a pattern. But, you know, I mean, if I'm... Here's the thing, though, right? If I am executing my pattern and the sequence of shots is coming out the same every time, but I just happen to be losing the point most of the time, it's still a pattern. It's just a very bad one, right? It's not meeting its goal. Right. And it is important to note too, folks, that when you go out and yes, Jake, I mean, I that's exactly it. I think I would encourage everybody who's listening and is interested in doing this, since you've listened to the previous two podcasts, right, and you've mapped your strengths and your weaknesses, and then you've thought about your philosophy as a player and you know what type of tennis you want to be playing, you should sit down and actually, using all that information, design a handful of patterns for yourself. And we'll talk a little bit in a second about maybe what kind of categories of patterns you should think about. But you design some patterns for yourself, and then you got to go out and actually try and use them. And hopefully you practice them too, and figure out what works for you and what doesn't work for you. Because the things that you think might make logical sense for you on paper, then you go out on the court, and it might not actually play out quite the way you expect it to. And that's fine. Right. But it just does give you a framework with which to be constantly kind of iterating your game and improving things a little bit by a little bit. And so when we think about what types of patterns that we have, this comes back a little bit to this idea of playing to your strengths, right? I mean, all of my patterns should have a goal of ending up with play where I want it to be.
Yes. I mean, yeah, like I want all my patterns to end with like a nice easy ball about shoulder high where I'm about 2 meters from the net.
Sure. And that may not be what everybody wants, right?
There's no, I'm like, just saying for me.
if you're early career Andy Roddick, you probably want that as a forehand that's shoulder high and you're standing around the service line, right?
Yeah,
you don't
that
want
would
that
be
as
great.
A volley.
He's going
right?
to win that point all the time.
Exactly. But whereas if it was the shoulder high volley, he probably would actually lose more than he would if he actually hitting ground strike forehand. No, I'm saying he's going to lose more points than if he's hitting the
that's
forehand.
Fair. That's right. That's because to be fair, and like Andy or Andy fans, that's because like that guy never lost points when he had a forehand on the service line. Like he was
absolutely.
Just lights out with that ball.
Yeah,
so,
I mean it's game over when he hits that shot. So he's going to win that point almost 100% of the time. Whereas if he got the shoulder high volley, he might win that point 80% of the time.
Right.
You know,
or
and so
it
that,
doesn't
that
matter, but
15 or 19% swing is massive, right? In real tennis terms. So maybe I'll just bring up a couple of examples of two patterns that are very fresh to me because I actually was working with a junior player earlier today on this. And so this guy, it was my first session work with him, and he's a younger guy. He's in high school still. He's got, you know, like a nice big forehand, solid serve. His tops and backhand's a little bit on the weaker side. He's got a pretty good slice, okay? And so one of the patterns that we were talking about ideas of how to shift play off the backhand onto the forehand, because he wants to be hitting forehands, and I think that's a very good move for him. And so when we think about on his service games, that's a lot easier because his serve's pretty solid, so there's going to be a lot of serve plus one taking place. But on the return games, you know, especially if we think about the deuce court, things aren't quite so easy, right? Because you return serve from the deuce court, and you're standing in the right-hand corner, you're standing in your forehand corner, there's a lot of room for somebody to hit your backhand. Yeah. And so you're going to end up hitting a lot of backhand as your first ball after the return. And so we looked at two possible scenarios here. So the first one was that we're playing somebody who's hitting a little bit of a heavier, loopier ball, okay, a little more spin, a little less pace. And if I hit that return from the deuce court, and now they hit like a heavier looping ball with a little bit of net clearance into my backhand corner, how do I get out of that situation? And so this was the pattern that we worked on today, was moving into that backhand corner on the run and playing a high loopy backhand cross court ourselves. By playing it cross court, we've made the line a little bit more difficult. And by putting the ball high, okay, we're pushing our opponent back a little bit, making it a little bit more harder, more difficult for them to attack.
Right.
And so what we're likely to get back from that is a higher loopier ball back into our backhand corner again. Because, A, that's the kind of play that we were playing to begin with. And, two, if I hit high and loopy, my opponent's more likely to hit high and loopy back. Because okay. The more change we introduce, the more likely we are to make errors. And so what we get to do then is he gets to not recover all the way and set up to be ready to run around that next ball and hit an inside-out forehand. Okay? And now he's at least neutral in the point. And then after hitting one inside-out forehand, we would expect the next ball to be a little weaker because he's hit his strength. And he's going to step in and hit a more aggressive inside-out forehand and then finish with an inside-in forehand to end the point. Okay? So right. We've gone from being on the run to our backhand corner off a high loopy ball to hitting a high loopy cross-court shot, setting up for an inside-out forehand, a more aggressive inside-out forehand, and an aggressive inside-in forehand to finish.
Gotcha.
That's one pattern, okay? But what happens if that pattern or that pattern that things don't start that way? If his opponent hits a harder, flatter ball into his backhand corner, taking that and hitting a high loopy ball for him isn't a good play because his backhand's just not built to do that well. Some people, that's right in their wheelhouse, right? They can take a waist-high ball and hit a high loopy, heavy topspin ball cross court all day long.
Right.
But this guy,
but some of us can't.
Yeah, exactly. And certainly that's not his strength. I mean, could he try it? Sure, but his odds of winning the point are going to go down. So in that situation, what we worked on was running into that backhand corner and playing a slice backhand back down the line right where the ball came from. Okay? Right? And our big focus... go ahead.
Yeah, no, I want to ask, like, how... That's not something that we would normally hear, okay? So
sure.
The way that you're talking about this, it's like, okay, we're going to do this not just because... it's harder for you to hit this high topspin cross court ball, but it seems like that's going to get a completely different reaction out of the opponent.
Yeah, absolutely. Because if I'm his opponent and I've just attacked his backhand, I'm moving a little bit to my left and I'm getting set up to hit another forehand and maybe even finish the point or come in. And so the big thing that we focused on with his down the line slice backhand that was on the run was keeping the ball low. I told him depth doesn't matter at this point. Doesn't matter whether you hit it short, you hit it deep, as long as you keep the ball low and keep your line reasonably up the line. Because then what we're going to do is we're going to force our opponent to run back out to their right and hit a ball that's a little bit lower, maybe down kind of knee height, which isn't exactly where we want to be attacking from. And,
right.
And where do you think that next shot's going to go, Jake?
Well, I mean, if I'm playing this guy who has a weak backhand, maybe I want to get it to his backhand, but going down the line on the run off of a low ball feels like I'm going to make a lot of errors doing that. So
yeah.
I'm probably trying to hit it cross court, trying to hit it well.
Yeah,
I mean,
right?
I think it depends on how, it could be anything. Like I could kind of just hit a ball that's not really an angle and that's not really that big to his forehand. Or if I do a really good job, maybe I can hit an angle to his forehand, but...
Yeah, but that's basically, I mean, your main options. Realistically, for most people, running and hitting that ball down the line off the low slice isn't really going to turn out so well. I mean, it's a very low margin shot. And so that's going to funnel play that the obvious shot is the cross-court forehand at that point. And so we're funneling play into the forehand, and we're doing so in a way where they can't even be particularly that aggressive about it because they're hitting it off a lower shot themselves. And so now we've gone from... We're running into our backhand corner. We're playing the low slice down the line, running into our forehand corner and playing an aggressive forehand down the line ourselves. So we've gone from defense to offense in two shots.
Okay,
is this going to work every single time? No. But is it going to work more often than most of the other options available? Yes.
Yes.
And that was the point of the pattern.
I like this because it doesn't matter to me if we're talking about a junior player, an adult player, or a pro player. We're all going to find ourselves in certain situations. Like every now and then, at some point, I'm going to be on the run into my backhand side. So it seems like with this structure, if it's okay for me to reach back into some of the things you talked about earlier, then I can actually practice, okay, running to the backhand, can I hit this high spinny cross court one that kind of neutralizes and sets me up to hit forehands and the inside out ones like you talked about? Or, okay, if I can't hit that one, then I can just practice my down the line slice and practice following that up with my down the line forehand.
Right.
And it seems like it's really specific. So in that I'm not having to go out there and feel like, you know, I have no direction, or like I just want to get my forehand better, which is like, of course, yeah, we all want to get our forehand better. We all want to get our backhand better. We all want to get our serve better. But that's so ambiguous and vague.
Right.
Like, what do I do, right? Like, most of us go out and practice. And I mean, to be realistic, some people spend hundreds of hours on the practice court without seeing hardly any improvement.
Right.
It seems impossible to me that I could go out and practice those two patterns for just 3 hours and that I wouldn't get better.
Exactly. And that's, you know, essentially what we spent a huge chunk of our time today doing, was practicing the first pattern a bunch and then practicing the second pattern a bunch. And then when he goes out to play matches, now, as we talked about bundled decisions, this isn't just like, oh God, what am I going to do on this shot? It's like I have two choices depending on the type of ball that I get. If the ball's lower and harder, I'm playing the slice. If it's loopier and higher, I'm playing the cross court high ball. And that's it. The decision has essentially been made 5 days before he stepped on the court to play the match.
Nice.
Right?
Nice.
And yeah, exactly. And so now he just gets to do the thing that he's already practiced. And there's not really, you know, there's no ambiguity about, oh God, what do I do now? It's, well, I know exactly what I'm doing.
All right.
I've practiced it.
Right. So that, I mean, this ties so much of this into, you know, one place, that it seems really strongly like if I start to make sense of what I'm doing in practice, right? If I go through some of these steps or I learn more about my game, I think more about what my overall philosophy is going to be. And then if I take the time to design some patterns that I want to practice, then going out and executing them, practicing them, you know, honestly, like a few times maybe, I don't know that you have to practice them for, you know, 100 hours, but just even I think practicing them for 5 hours or 10 hours, I feel
not
like, geez,
once,
my
folks.
Confidence...
Don't do it all at once, right?
We're talking about I mean,
multiple,
I mean,
practice sessions.
10 hours spread out over however many weeks or whatever it is, right? But the point being, like, if I go through all those steps, I mean, how confident am I going to be, right? It feels like everything will have been determined towards doing really specific things, not just towards hitting a good backhand and hitting a good forehand.
Exactly. And this is one of the things I think this gets lost for a lot of players as they're thinking about tennis, is that I think when people watch the top pros play, that they attribute a lot of what happens out there to magic. I mean, people will certainly talk about Federer a lot that way, like there's something magical about Federer's play. And the
right.
truth is, no, there's a lot of design in everything Federer does, and he just makes it look easy. He makes it look magical at times. But most of these top guys are going out in court, especially the ones who have clearly sustained success, are going out on court with very well-developed patterns that they've used and executed for years. And when we look at, and you could think about this yourself, folks, when you think about the players on the pro circuit who are touted as underachievers, somebody like Fernando Verdasco, or traditionally like Grigor Dimitrov, or Murat Safin, we're talking about players who never played with well-developed patterns. They were pretty much making it up as they went along.
And
it
shows. And I love that. It shows.
Yeah, it shows. I mean, it shows.
Oh, it shows. Yeah.
Yeah.
It shows. Yeah. I was going to say, I love that you throw Dimitrov in there, because it's really clear from watching him that he's hitting the ball the same way he's been hitting the ball for years. He's always been one of the most athletic guys.
Mm-hmm.
But he's playing, one way to look at it is like much more disciplined. But now with this framework, I just think of it as, oh, he's just playing his patterns.
Yeah, exactly. And also worth noting is, you know, when we look over his results from last year, He now has patterns that work for him for his game on hard court. He does not yes. have patterns that work for him for his game on clay court.
Oh, the little
teaser.
And that
shows. That shows exactly when you look at his clay court results from last year. It's not that Dimitrov is a bad clay court player. It's not that he doesn't have the tools to be successful in clay. It's that he doesn't have patterns that work for him on that surface yet. Hopefully he figures it out. But again, there's a multitude of players that you can think of, if you put a little effort into it, that have underachieved because of that lack of direction inside of points. And so, folks, if you have any questions about that, then feel free to shoot us an email and ask us. You can reach me at glenn@tacticaltennis.com.
I'm Jacob at tacticaltennis.com, or hit us up on Twitter at tacticaltennis, or check out the Instagram at tacticaltennis as well.
Right. And if you haven't already, you can sign up for the emails on the website. That's pretty easy. It is free. And what you will find in those is every week to 2 weeks to sometimes 3 weeks, depending on travel schedule, you'll get an email with some content that isn't really on the website, at least certainly not yet, with some ideas and thoughts that hopefully will help you continue to develop your game. And if you haven't done this as well, please do us a favor and go to iTunes or Stitcher or whatever your podcast app is and rate the show. We don't advertise, and the more that you can do things like rate and share, have a listening party by all means, that helps us out to grow our listening audience, which, you know, hopefully is a good thing, and we'd appreciate you taking the time to do that.
It's fun for us. And if you have anything that you really want to complain about in that rating, please email us. We're giving you personal emails for a reason.
Yeah, you can email nice things too. But if you want to complain about something, you can absolutely.
Just send the nice things to Glenn. If you want to complain, send all those things my way. I'd love to hear the complaints.
Okay, you heard it. You heard it here. Well, all right, folks, have a great day.
Take it easy, guys.